Ugh.
Hey!
He's gonna make a bassoon joke.
Is that a bassoon in your hand, or are you just pleased to see me?
Would you say that to your son?
When he has his bassoon, sure. But he's never pleased to see me, so.
That doesn't even make sense. Why would a bassoon in my hand?
Like a dick in your hand.
Oh, right, so if I was walking towards you with an amputated dick in my hand, you'd think I was horny.
Well, I'd assume that you had been. Certainly wouldn't put it past you to chop a dick off.
Put the guinea pig down.
Hello, and welcome to The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast. On today's show, I got to talk to one of my favorite comic actors, Brett Gelman. Brett is in pretty much everything on TV, but you can really hear me fanboy out over Fleabag Season 2, which I've watched at least four times, if not more, at this point. Brett plays Martin, the creepy brother-in-law to Phoebe Waller-Bridge's character, and he is so, so funny in the show. We talked about how he got that part at the very last minute, how he feels about playing various shades of toxic masculinity in most of his roles, and a lot more. Brett also teased a new project he wants to make that is inspired by Kanye West, so you'll have to listen to the show to hear more about that. Before we get to Brett, I want to remind you again to please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know who your favorite guest has been so far, who else do you want to see on the show, and just let us know what you're thinking. So it really helps people find the show, and I hope you can do that. So without further ado, let's get to my interview with Brett Gelman.
It's a very pretty color on this microphone.
Yeah.
I like it.
thank you for doing this.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I not only wanted to talk to you because you're, you know, a beard idol of mine.
Oh, really?
But... But also because of Fleabag.
You have a tremendous beard.
Oh, thank you. I was just fishing for a compliment there.
No, you look great.
Also, Fleabag is where I really want to start and
yes.
talk a lot about that because I've become slightly obsessed with especially the second season,
mm-hmm.
as a lot of people have, I think.
Yes.
I've somehow watched the whole thing four times through
wow.
already because
yeah.
I watched it by myself, and then I watched it with my wife, and then we've had other people over to watch it because you can kind of watch the whole thing in one or two sittings.
The whole series or season?
You could watch the whole series in one sitting, but really the second season or series
yeah,
or however we want to call it. It's pretty incredible.
It's a 3-hour
yeah.
movie, the second season.
So I really want to get into that and talk about it. So how did you kind of get involved in that to begin with? Because I know you were kind of cast at the last minute, right?
I was, yeah. It was a really very strange occurrence, me becoming involved with the show. Yeah, I got a call on a Wednesday from an Amazon executive who's an old friend of mine named Ryan Andolina.
Mm-hmm.
It was like at 9 p.m.
Yeah.
And he calls me and he's like, hey, man, we've acquisitioned the show from the BBC. It's called Fleabag. It's based on the one-person show of this incredibly talented writer-performer, Phoebe Waller-Bridge. She did it at Edinburgh and it was a real smash there. And I don't think he said smash. Yeah, we shot the pilot, and we have the rest of the scripts, and we think that you'd be perfect for this character, the character of her brother-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to send it all over to you and, you know, tell us what you think. I was like, wow, great. He's like, yeah, I would shoot in London for like a month. I had never been to London.
Yeah, so. And you're in L.A. at this point, or?
Yeah, I'm in Los Angeles, and I had never been to London,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, probably the number one place that I wanted to go,
yeah.
just because there's so many things that have come out of that country
mm-hmm.
and that city that mean a lot to me. And so I just was like, you know, I was like, well, this is going to really have to be a piece of shit to justify me not going to London.
Yeah.
I watched the pilot, and so I was just like, yeah, so, I'll check it out. He's like, great. If you can let me know really soon, because your first day of shooting will be Tuesday, which
wow.
was like 5 days from then.
Yeah.
So I had to, I watched the pilot and I was like, well, this is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I skimmed the scripts.
Yeah.
I didn't feel the need to read all of them at that point.
Yeah.
And I just told him, yes.
And what were your first impressions of Phoebe Waller-Bridge when you got to meet her when you went over?
Oh, immediately lovely. I mean, her and Harry Bradbeard, the director of the show, who's her partner in crime, one of her partners in crime, they got there and I shot like that first day. Mm-hmm. It was great. I was
Do you remember the first,
super
jet-lagged. The first thing you shot?
What was the first thing we shot? I mean, we shot a bunch my first day. We shot the scene in the bar. Mm-hmm. That might have been the first thing that we shot.
Yeah.
The scene in the bar where we're talking after our, you know, before we go to the shoe store, I believe. We also shot the shoe store, I think, that day. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I mean, Phoebe and Harry were immediately, they were lovely, you know.
Yeah.
Most people from the UK, they're like immediately lovely. They might be hating you down
deep. They seem very lovely.
But they make you think that they're at least graciously tolerating you.
Yeah.
And but they came into my trailer and I could tell that they were a little wary. I mean, they had never met me. Mm-hmm. And I do. And I think that it was Amazon's idea that I take this role.
Mm-hmm. Was it always an American?
No, it was a Scot.
Oh really? And they written the Scot. So do you think they had someone cast that fell out, or do you know?
I think so.
Yeah,
it
seems like it.
I
if it was
if
that
you're getting
last
a call,
minute.
Yeah, I think if you're getting a call with less than a week, someone was sacked. So I don't know who.
Yeah.
I don't know who. Yeah. I honestly don't. They seemed wary, and you know, we talked about the character, and they just made sure that I was somewhat on board, you know, on the same page as them, as how the character was going to be, and they liked what I had to say. And then by the time that we were shooting, we had shot a few scenes. It was I felt not judgment, but you know, that wariness leave.
They trusted you a little bit at that point.
Yes, they did. And it becomes clear too that, like, you know, it's she's immediately lovely. Mm-hmm. She's immediately a person with a vision though as well.
Yeah.
You're coming into a room. You get this with
it feels very choreographed and specific. And,
incredibly.
So I imagine there was not a lot of room for improv. Is it very
absolutely
heavily
not
scripted?
No. And you want to get all of her words word perfect because it's delicious writing. It's really incredible. So, I mean, with her and with others that I work with, I don't really bring up improvisation. Of course, something can come up.
Mm-hmm.
There's like little moments that can come up, and sometimes it's like finding it. So it's her, you know, bouncing things off a little bit to make the moment, because she's so precise. So it's, you know, how do we do this here? She rewrote a lot of my scenes in season two, like 5 minutes before we shot
them. Just because
we would show up and she would be like, "This is shit," and this isn't good. I was like, "Well, this is really brilliant, I think." She's like, no. And then we'd sit there and she'd sort of, you know, use me and a few others as a sounding board, and then she'd present the new script, and you're like, "Oh, well, no, it is better."
Do you remember an example of that, or one scene that really changed because of discussions?
My monologue at the end of season two.
Listen to me. I
think he has a little speech.
I have a little speech that's building here. Now, I know you look at me and you see a bad man with a big beard.
You are an alcoholic and you tried it on with my sister.
Fine. I tried to kiss your sister on her birthday.
My birthday?
Fine. I mix up birthdays and I have an alcohol problem just like everyone else in this fucking country. But I am here and I do things. I pick up Jake from shit. I make dessert for Easter. I organize the downstairs toilet. I fired the humming cleaner.
You enjoyed that.
I hoovered the car. I put up all your certificates and I don't make you feel guilty for not having sex with me. I am not a bad guy. I just have a bad personality. It's not my fault. Some people are born with fucked personalities. Look at Jake. He is so creepy. It's not his fault. Why the bassoon? You want to know what the bassoon is? It's a cry for help. The main fucking problem here is that you don't like me. And that has been breaking my fucking heart for 11 years. I love you. I make you laugh. I'm a douche, but I make you laugh. You said that was the most important thing.
I think the thing that you hate the most about yourself is that you actually love me. So, I am not going to leave you until you are down on your knees begging me.
Please leave me.
Your character, Martin, has this incredible arc over the course of the second season leading up to that monologue where, you know, we're pretty... He's definitely an antagonist for most of the series. But
yeah.
Then there's this really lovely, you know, kind of sympathetic moment that you get at the end with that monologue. And you said that it was kind of rewritten right before. So was that part of the discussion? What did it look like before it was rewritten?
I really don't remember, actually. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, in all honesty... I thought it was incredible. Mm-hmm. So, but I showed up to set and then she was like, this is shit. And I was like, okay. and when I say like, this is shit, it's think of somebody who, when they say this is shit, it's like still like beautiful.
It's
and
very
she's
sweet,
like describing a dessert that she had last night. she's like, yeah, this just doesn't sound like you. It doesn't sound like Martin.
Yeah.
I have to make it sound like him. And so on the ride to set, she was rewriting it. And then there was a scene that we shot before we shot that. So while I was acting that scene, I would be on my break memorizing the monologue and rehearsing it with her and with Harry and with Sean.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that moment where you scream, I'm not a bad guy. I just have a bad personality.
Yes.
Has become kind of a mantra for that character. I think that's what people think of with that character now. Does that stand out for you in that way?
The whole time I was playing him, you know, I have, you're not judging your character while you're playing him.
Yeah.
And then you're also in a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And Phoebe makes it very clear that, like, this is a comedy. Like, because I would really sort of dramatically mess it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not the lines, but the timing.
Mm-hmm.
And she would be like, no, this is a comedy. Like, make sure to play a comedy.
Yeah.
And so then you have to meet that level comedically.
Mm-hmm.
And so that means intensifying all of the justifications and psychology of the character to heighten it to this way, which then I guess meant heightening his anger and his sense of betrayal. I mean, for me, like, it's all about that the character has this sense of betrayal, that that he is alone, he is in this failing marriage, he hates himself, he's an alcoholic, he knows that he is completely fucked up.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the first season, he had a chance to connect with someone. Because, I mean, and we said this to each other, we were like, you know, Fleabag and Martin are actually the two most similar characters in this show.
Yeah.
They both are on the outside. They both connect, you know, they both use humor as a way to, you know, act out.
Mm-hmm.
And they both have like this distinct sense of self-hatred. But season two is sort of a, you know, it's about Fleabag rising out of that a bit and very much about Martin sinking into it more.
Yeah.
And so that last monologue, it wasn't as big of a surprise to me just because of, in my mind, what his arc was through season two.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was just that he knows that his life is falling apart and that he's going to lose her. But
And there's a moment where you think he might not, and she might, forgive him.
Yeah.
The Claire character in some way. But then, of course, there's that hilarious moment where she gets down on her knees to beg.
Yeah. I mean, it's all about, like, it is going back to that line, you know, some people aren't bad. They just have, I'm not bad, I have a bad personality. I can relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
You feel sometimes that, oh, wow, can I change?
Mm-hmm.
Is it actually possible to change? And I think this is a big theme of the show.
Yeah.
Or am I just fucked? Do I just have this person? Am I cursed?
Mm-hmm.
Was I born with this person? And is there no shaking this?
Yeah. You feel like you can relate to that in your own life?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. At times when I've felt, I can relate to every aspect of Martin besides like the like full on aggression towards women, but you know, but that you have to, but from where that's coming from the starting point, I can certainly relate to.
How would you describe the type of character that you've often been hired to portray? Whether it's Martin is a good example of it, thinking about the character on Love, who's the station director who has a contentious relationship with Gillian's character.
Yeah.
You know, how would you describe that person?
The Isaac from Lemon, which Nick Sabrina's film. You know, these are.
I think that's almost the ultimate version of it in some ways.
I think a lot of it is about you know, it's, I mean, yeah, it's a level of, it's all these different shades of toxic masculinity, right? I think that people like to cast me in those roles, and I mean, of course, I co-wrote Lemon because I enjoy diving into flaws. You know, not that I don't enjoy playing less flawed characters, but I think that I'd like to think that I humanize these guys and give them some empathy and make people scared that they might relate to certain aspects of them.
Yeah.
And I grew up like loving actors who played these types of characters.
Like who?
I mean, I worshipped Danny DeVito when I was a kid. I loved John Larroquette, A Night Court. When I got older, I loved, you know, Raging Bull. So it's like playing these really flawed, toxic men who are caught in this downward spiral. And there's certainly many points in my life, and I don't know, point every day where, you know, I don't necessarily go down the spiral, but I see it there. And it's great to be able to exercise that in my acting.
Yeah. Do you feel like there's a catharsis for you to play those characters?
Absolutely.
And get something out?
Absolutely. I don't walk away from a day of working on those characters feeling worse. I feel better. And they're all, and it's also, you know, it's about fragility, privilege. You know, these guys think that they deserve more than they get, and there's a big resentment for that. And I think that that's a definite form of privilege.
Something that's come up, I was reading, you know, old interviews with you, the issue of unlikable characters comes up a lot, and I know you have you know, strong feelings about that. Do you feel like that's getting better, this idea that unlikable characters are not allowed to be on TV? Because it does seem like there are more and more of them, whether audiences are enjoying them or not.
Oh, I think they have always been allowed to be on TV.
Yeah.
I just am always surprised when people come out and say that this is that you know, they say the word unlikable almost like it's new. And it's like, well, I don't know. King Lear is a pretty unlikable character if you look at him. You know, Blanche DuBois, you know, Amanda from Glass Menagerie is a pretty unlikable character, I guess. But why else are we watching art if not to see? It's not like a perfect person party. And so, yeah, I think that people are definitely in television really leaning into that more. But you also have to keep leaning into it, and there's different stages of being afraid of presenting that.
I mean, the critical success and now all these Emmy nominations for Fleabag, I think, is a good endorsement of that. That it's really being embraced.
I think she's done a genre of this show, which is this, you know, female driven show that is like feminist, and I think that she's nailed it the best. Because she has leaned into the flaws so unapologetically and humanistically in a way that not many artists have, you know, and that's why people are freaking out about her.
She's said that this is it in terms of the two seasons, that it's over.
Right.
Would you want to do more of it?
Of course.
Yeah.
Do it for a year. I will do anything that person asks me to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, she's talked about how she feels like the character has, you know, reached this endpoint, and it, there is something very...
She always feels that
Yeah, way. Noble about walking away from something and not letting it, you know, get past the expiration date.
Part of what makes her such an incredible artist is she's very much in the moment with what she wants to do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, right now she doesn't want to do another season. Mm-hmm. Could she change her mind? Absolutely. Could she not? Totally.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I hope that she changes her mind.
Yeah.
Or if she doesn't, I hope that she makes something else and then puts me in that.
Yeah, yeah. James Bond, isn't she doing something with James Bond?
Yes, yes.
You're doing not the next James Bond, are you?
No, I would love to. I would love to be a James Bond villain.
I could see that.
I definitely think I was like, wow. I mean, really. Martin's a pretty good audition for a supervillain, you know, in a franchise. Yeah,
yeah, that would be good.
Coming up, Brett talks about how he thought he was too good for improv comedy before he saw his first show at UCB.
So I want to go back a little bit. You grew up in the suburbs of Chicago in Highland Park, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually have some family in Highland Park, so I know it.
Yeah, hence the self-hatred. Yeah. A lot of Highland Park and all my characters.
Yeah.
Or me as a, you know, my reaction to it. Yeah.
What was your relationship to comedy growing up? Were you
obsessed?
Were you, yeah.
Yeah.
What were your big things that you loved?
Well, I mean, the Marx Brothers. Mm-hmm. That's what made me want to do it, like 6 years old. Mm-hmm. I saw A Night at the Opera.
Was that something your parents showed you?
My uncle was like doing their voices one day in the car, and I was like, "What's that?" Because mm-hmm. there's no better voices than Groucho and Chico. And I think he was doing a routine. I think you can't fool me. There ain't no sanity clause routine.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing from Night at the Opera, something like that. And I was like, "Who is that?" And he's like, "Oh, that's the Marx Brothers. You should check them out."
Mm-hmm.
And so then I went to the library and rented A Night at the Opera. This is when we rented the only place to rent videos mm-hmm. from was the library. This was in 1954. and then I watched it. I of course didn't understand any of the things that Groucho or Chico were saying.
Mm-hmm.
I got a good view into what Harpo was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Harpo,
the physical comedy.
Harpo can reach a young age. Mm-hmm. But I knew that what Groucho and Chico were saying was amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And Groucho's voice in particular, mm-hmm. it is still the finest music to my ear.
Yeah. And then where did you kind of go from there in your comedy?
I mean, Mel Brooks was the next thing. So mm-hmm. that was, I think, the holy trinity of comedic movies are the producers, Young Frankenstein and Blazing Saddles.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think those are the three funniest films ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And then 2000-Year-Old Man and all of his other films, too, I love. I was upset. I mean, the old Saturday Night Live guys, you know, it was mm-hmm. the 80s. So it was like, especially Bill Murray mm-hmm. coming out with so many classic movies.
Yeah. And were you aware of, Second City being so close to where you were?
By the time
people had come out of there?
Yeah. By the time I got a little older, I was aware. I went there one time on my birthday. My parents took me there, and we saw the main stage show, and Stephen Colbert, what they do at Second City is they'll come out in a sketch, and if they know it's somebody's birthday, they'll say their character's name is that person.
Oh, really?
And Colbert came out and said, "Hello, I'm Brett Gelman."
That's hilarious.
That's crazy.
That's great. Have you told him that story?
I think I have. Yeah. I think I have. I don't think he would remember. I mean, I don't know if he would even remember meeting me.
Mm-hmm.
We've like spent a little time here and there. I did like a short bit on his show years ago.
Mm, yeah.
And then I was backstage at an event that he was in, and mm-hmm. we were somehow in the same like holding room,
mm-hmm.
Just me and him. Mm-hmm. And he was so incredibly nice.
That's great.
I mean, he's incredible. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, Eddie Murphy
mm-hmm.
And then I got exposed to Monty Python, and of course Chaplin was like huge mm-hmm. for me around, yeah. you know, it was one of the hugest people for me early on.
You eventually studied theater in college. Were you always at that point thinking about comedy, or were you thinking about doing dramatic work, or how did you imagine this would go?
In high school, my high school had a great theater department. Mm. So that's where I really started to learn about theater and where I started to get more connected to more dramatic things as well. And, but I always, you know, people always were more inclined to cast me in comedy and put me in, you know, not everybody can do comedy.
Yeah.
You can teach a lot of people how to act. You can't really teach people how to be funny.
Yeah.
There's got to be something wrong with them. Mm-hmm. I was training in that way, though, the whole time. It's not like they were training me just to be a comedic actor. You know, it was a classical training program.
Yeah.
So it was really intense.
Do you feel like you still use things that you learned in that program today?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Every day when I'm walking down the street, you know. You know, I'm aligning the back of my neck.
Right.
Alexander technique.
Yeah, a lot of movement.
It was really like tuning your body to do the hardest writing that's ever been written, which is Shakespeare.
Yeah.
So it was great. I mean, it really, and it definitely propelled. So once I got to New York and I started doing UCB, I think I rose up in the ranks there pretty fast because it was so early on there. I was one of the only people who knew how to be on a stage.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. What year was that you started working with them? Or do we know?
1999.
Oh, wow. Yeah, those are early days.
20 years ago.
Wow.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what was that like? Did you feel like you had found your people when you got to UCB?
Yeah, of course. Like at first I had snubbed it. My friend John Daly, who was only at my school at North Carolina for like 2 years, he had left and went to New York. And he was like, you know, you got to check out this place. You know, there's a show here called Ass Cat. Andy Richter does it sometimes.
Yeah.
Because that was the only, you know, person that I would know who was doing it at that time.
He was
time.
Already on Conan.
Exactly.
Point, yeah.
Yeah. And so he's like, this is the best improvising that I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And so I was like, well, no, maybe if I have like some time, I'm going to be a Broadway star.
Yeah.
So then you do the whole like consortium for all the, you know, like old Battle Axe agents and casting directors when right before it changed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then that time they were only taking like, can you be on a soap?
Oh, yeah.
And I felt very good about my scenes.
Auditions for soaps?
For
Broadway?
For these, you know, agents that would then, you know, hopefully realize your Broadway dreams, which they, of course, wouldn't do.
Yeah.
That would, of course, still take time. But I wasn't signed by anybody. And like, I remember like one agent like had a courtesy meeting with me. And she was like, yeah, you're a character actor, kid. You'll work when you're 50.
Mm-hmm.
I proved her wrong. I have to be on stage, you know, I have to act I start to feel like I'm like shriveling away if I don't do it for a certain amount of time. So I just, I started taking classes there and I felt immediately, I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. This is so amazing. And I got addicted to it and addicted to the theater. And I wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't for the Upright Citizens Brigade.
Yeah. Do you feel like when you look back, is there a moment that you feel like was your, you know, cliched big break or first thing that you really felt that you were recognized for?
That's like a multi-layered question because like in some ways like the first thing that I ever felt like I really was like, this is my, you know, this is something that some people are seeing that I'm proud of was this thing that I did for Funny or Die Presents called 1,000 Cats, which was this one-man musical that I had done at UCB for like on and off for like 8 years that like Andrew Steele and Jason Wallner was asked what he wanted to do for their series, you know, on HBO. And then he was like, well, one of the things I want to do is this. And we were talking about Scott Aukerman before.
Mm-hmm.
And so like Scott Aukerman and then BJ Porter, who was also, they were a team at that point and they were both running Comedy Death Ray before it was Comedy Bang Bang.
And that was out here.
Yeah. And they let me perform it before Death Ray one night so that Andrew Steele, could, Head of Funny or Die, could come and see it.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was like, this is great, but I need McKay to see it.
Mm, Adam McKay, yeah.
Yes. Heard of him.
Yeah.
And he and then Scott and BJ graciously were like, no, you can do it next week so Adam can come.
Mm.
And then McKay came and brought his kid, brought his daughter to watch 1,000 Cats.
Yeah. Which,
and then
how did
yeah,
that go?
It went great.
Yeah.
And then HBO hated it when we filmed it. It was supposed to be 12 minutes. It was 17. They were like, you got to like cut this down or yeah, cut this up throughout
the whole
the
show
episode.
Was only like 30 minutes, right?
Right. And the, and Andrew was like, and I was like, okay, well, let's do it. And Andrew was like, no. This has got to be how it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, we'll get Will to call HBO if Will likes it.
Will Ferrell. Yeah.
And then Will Ferrell saved it.
Yeah.
Watched it, liked it. And then like the next highlight I would say that was like a big point for me was when I did The Other Guys.
Mm, yeah. With that Adam McKay directing and
yeah, and Will Ferrell acting, and like that was two of the best days of my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was really
what made it so great?
We laughed like for 2 days straight. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. And then to be improvising with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg and Natalie Zia, and like it was just it felt like a magical scene.
Mm-hmm.
And to have those guys like giving me lines to say. Mm-hmm. And then improvising and making them laugh. I mean, these guys were like, you know, these were the titans, you know. This is like coming up at UCB, it was like these were the guys. I mean, I would watch, you know, I was watching Will Ferrell on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
And then watching Adam's writing on Saturday Night Live and directing on Saturday Night Live when he would do his short films, which I loved. And then watching Adam perform at UCB sometimes. Mm-hmm. And being like one of the most brilliant improvisers I'd ever seen, ever. And I don't know, it was like, yeah, these heroes. And then they were like taking me under their wing. And I was doing them proud.
Did you ever audition for SNL?
Sort of. I mean, it was a favor to Horatio Sanz, mm-hmm, you know, who's a very dear
letting
friend
you
of mine.
Letting you audition was a favor to Horatio Sanz?
He just
Sanz?
Was like, yeah, he was like, let my buddy Brett audition. And everybody loves Raj. That's what, mm-hmm, what yeah, they yeah, call him. And so it was like at the nightclub. It wasn't like in the mm-hmm room. It wasn't yeah, a real audition. Mm-hmm. It was basically like, all right, get him up and get him out of here. Mm-hmm. And then like making tapes for them and things like that. And mm-hmm then sometimes there would be showcases for Lorne at mm-hmm UCB.
Yeah. Was that something that you really wanted or
no, definitely.
Of, yeah.
Definitely. That was like mm-hmm a dream. But now looking at where I'm at, it makes sense that I did not do it.
Yeah.
I don't regret it at all. Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about is the dinner series of specials for Adult Swim, which I love.
Thank you.
And are
thank
so great
you
for anyone who hasn't seen them. You can find them on some on YouTube and on Adult Swim's website. Can you describe what the original concept was for this and in case people don't know?
Yeah, the original concept was basically to have a comedy special around a dinner table.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, there were like lots of bits at the table, like me doing characters and things like that. And, you know, to Mike Lazzo's credit, he told me and Jason Wolner, who co-wrote them and co-created it and then directed it. He's, you know, was like this stuff, like the bits around the table. It's like I just thought it was going to be Brett fucking with somebody at around the dinner table. I can swear, right?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Okay. Okay. And so that was actually a great note. And that is, you know, to Lazzo's credit, I mean, you know, we've had some disagreements, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm, but Mike was like, it was a great note. He's very good at giving a simple note like that. And so we took that and we sort of turned it into this sort of funny games type thing of this sadistic host just deciding to psychologically and physically, in some cases, torture his guests.
Yeah.
And then, and so that was Dinner with Friends with Brett Gelman and Brett Gelman's friends. Mm-hmm. And then the second mm-hmm one was about family and yeah, family dysfunction. And that was Dinner with Family with Brett Gelman and Brett Gelman's family.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I mean, Jason and I think we're both dealing with a lot of family things. I mean, we're Jews, so, you know, you're going to have a lot of stuff to go on. And, And then the third one, we wanted to do something on race.
Yeah.
And I mean, so that was Dinner in America with Brett Gelman and Brett Gelman's And that we wanted to be like a full indictment of white liberal racism.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty incredible, that special. It came out in 2016 before the election.
Yes.
And
right.
I think it feels even more relevant now watching it than it did then in some ways.
I'm very proud of it.
Yeah. I mean, it was pretty out there. It was pretty daring, I would say. You had some famous black actors at the table with you.
Yeah, Joe Morton, Loretta Devine, mm-hmm. Mack Wilds, mm-hmm. Sharika Epps, and then Lance Reddick does, mm-hmm. who was in the first one,
yeah.
comes back to do an absolutely brilliant cameo mm-hmm. in that.
Yeah, and so with that one, what were you aiming to achieve? Because it is more, it feels like more than just a comedy special in a lot of ways.
Well, in being with Janixa Bravo, mm-hmm. who...
Your wife.
Yeah, well, she's now my ex-wife. Oh. Yeah, but best friend and mm-hmm. collaborator still. Mm-hmm. Her and I, you know, just seeing... I was always somebody who was drawn to civil rights and but I, of course, like, lived in a complete bubble of privilege still, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then being so intimate with somebody and you seeing how the reality of this country and how people of color are treated affects them in the most minuscule ways every day. And that you see that that's coming from people who believe themselves not to be racist, yeah. including me.
Mm-hmm.
That I just was like, I started to really notice that, like, oh, this is so deeply programmed into us. And seeing that I just wanted to make something that put that on blast, you mm-hmm. know, and showed it in a expressionistic way.
Yeah, there's a monologue that Joe Morton delivers that's especially affecting, I think. What was the process of writing that like? Because it really does, it's from his perspective. And so how did you work with him on that, or how did you just bring it to him, or how did that work?
I just brought it to him.
Mm-hmm.
I love how Joe Morton does a monologue.
Yeah.
Say something!
You want me to say something? Fine. I'll say something. You people. You're not a race. You are a virus. You destroy the world. Everything beautiful, you poison. You drag us from our homes. You rape our daughters, murder our sons. You crack our spines and do all you can to break our will. You stab us. Then you put the knife in our hand and tell us it's our fault. And if you don't do it yourself, you stand by, close your eyes, and pretend there's nothing wrong. And then you pray to your God to silence our screams so that you can enjoy the happiness that we built for you with our blood. But it's not your fault. It's the only way you know how to be. And the only thing that will change anything is if another virus comes along and does to you what you do to us. And I hope that happens very soon.
Wow. This evening obviously hasn't gone as I'd hoped. And I think I'm having a full-on panic attack right now. So I'm gonna go to the bathroom and get myself together. And when I come back, I hope you don't see me as the devil.
But I feel that
mm-hmm.
at times.
Yeah.
It does the I think the content of that monologue at times when you look at what's going on in the world and what has always gone on in the world, like, is this, you know, is this somewhat, this feels true at times. Obviously, this is all has to do with psychology and things like that. And, you know, the white race isn't really a virus, but it's, you know, it's there's a major problem. And then I also wanted to show, I wanted to, you know, a big thing that going into that, Jason and I really wanted to explore, like, yeah, we're two like white Jewish guys. Let's try to represent other people who are different from us in our writing in a way that, that they, you know, that's not, that's something that a person of color might say, you know, in an extreme situation, in a totally absurd piece.
Yeah.
Coming up, Brett explains why he decided to take a stand and walk away from Adult Swim after they greenlit the alt-right sketch show Million Dollar Extreme.
You alluded to this, but you did have this kind of public break from Adult Swim after that, where you announced that you weren't going to work with them anymore, I believe mostly because there was a they had a lack of projects helmed by women.
Yeah, and also among that other, they had greenlit a show that was... It was, and it wasn't even like even so much about the show. It was about the activity of the people on that show, too.
What was that?
But it was also about the contents. I mean, and I mean, just like they were trolls. They were
kind of like
they were abusing people.
Show.
Yeah, they were completely alt-right. And I'm sorry, I don't got time for that.
Yeah.
And yes, I don't think you should be put in jail. But this is a business. And I don't want to be a part of a business that's employing people like that, you know? So I left. It wasn't like, you know, it got colored that, like, that there were all these ridiculous conspiracies of why I had left. But I just was like, I'm like, it's like, I didn't come back after they canceled and started hiring women.
Yeah.
I just was like, this is bullshit and I'm out. And that's what I said. And I said, yeah, but they should start hiring women and they should cancel this show because it's toxic, especially, and it's being done by bad people. So, I mean, they, So it just...
Was that a hard decision for you? Because this was a place that was letting you, you know, make these specials, like the dinner specials. It's kind of hard to imagine those existing a lot of other places.
No, and I owe Adult Swim a lot, you know? I mean, they really, you know, not only those specials, but Eagle Heart, you know, is a show I'm really proud of. And that was like my first regular job on a show, you know, where I was a regular cast member. And they let, you know, they do let you go for it. I just thought, I just felt like it was becoming irresponsible. I was like, this is irresponsibility and this is too many dudes in the room. And this is a an industry-wide problem. I'd say that everything has this problem, but it was just so... It was so aggressive.
Yeah.
And I felt like, oh, I'm in this bubble. I also felt like what I was doing there was not being appreciated in the way that I wanted it to. It just is like, you know, Adult Swim is the star. You know, the network is the star. And you're like its supporting character when you put up your work there. And... It just felt like it was time to grow up a little bit more for me, you know.
Yeah.
And I got to do those, and there were other ways to take what I was saying in the show, and maybe it can't be in so absurd of a way, at certain places. But then you can still go that deep, and
Are there other different types of comedy specials that you are wanting to do or looking to do in terms of, you know, along those same lines?
Yeah. I have one in mind. Yeah. It's also a dinner.
Yeah.
But, oh man, should I announce this? Should I say this here? Should we drop this
exclusive
here? But I haven't brought this out at all.
Yeah.
But what I want to do, you know, Kanye West is very inspiring to me, despite
to a lot of people,
despite the whatever happened there, which is a very complicated thing to discuss, which I am in no position to discuss. Mm-hmm. But I love him. You know, I love his work. And I you know, you hear about these Sunday services that are going on. Yeah. And I haven't seen it, but it sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, why don't we do Friday night Shabbat dinner? And not as a parody of that, just inspired by that somewhat. Mm-hmm. And that's I haven't great. Seen it, and I don't know the contents of what happens in the show, even. But I always admire like how Kanye's always pulling from all of these different mediums and just bringing all these different things, you know, juxtapositions together in his work. And I was like, well, maybe I can put on, especially in light of the current situation in the world where anti-Semitism is growing. And yeah, sure, LA, it's fine. But, you know, you go into a lot of places in the country and you go into a lot of places in the world and I am suddenly not white.
Right, yeah.
And so, yeah, I really want to do, like, in the way that he seems to be doing the celebration of black culture and black music, I want to do sort of a celebration of Jewish culture in around these dinners that would be done in a gallery type space in an avant-garde way, but something that
you'd have maybe some Jewish comic guests with.
I mean, my like dream would be like that. One of the things that would happen is like, you know, Larry David and Richard Lewis would get into a gigantic argument at the table, but yeah, be celebrating Jewish culture through the humor and the way that that Kanye's celebrating black culture through the music.
I think that's a great idea. I hope I hope you can do it.
I'm gonna try.
Yeah, you don't know where it would live or.
I don't know. I mean, I might start it out as just like a live thing to like you know have an exclusive guest list for a while and then workshop it and build it and then before I start inviting people to maybe film it.
Yeah, well, I'll be very excited to come check.
You will
that
be
out.
On the list, my friend. You will be on the list, of course.
So what I want to do now, as we start to wrap up, is go through some of the things in your career that we haven't talked about. And you've obviously done so much stuff, and I think you're often people talk about you as someone who's in everything at once.
My address is, I write it down as television. Just kidding.
I just want to do a kind of speed round where we go through these, and you can let me know if there's a story or memory that kind of jumps out to you about them. So the first is working with Larry David, who you mentioned, on Curb Your Enthusiasm. You were the famously the Pig Parker.
Yeah.
What was it like to work with him?
It was like a dream come true. Dream come true. I mean, it was crazy.
Are you happy with that, Park?
Yeah, what's wrong with that?
You're way outside the line. You're taking up two spaces.
I'm like an inch over the line.
No, you're a foot over the line. You're taking up two spaces. And the next car is also going to be taking up two spaces. Then you're going to leave. And then that car is going to get blamed. This is chaos. Society can't function like this.
What?
You have to be in the lines the way it's supposed to be.
Here's an idea. Why don't you mind your own business?
Well, I suppose that's an idea. Not a very good one, though.
Oh, no?
Just say, you know what? I'll do better next time.
I did fine.
No, that's not fine.
I need to do better.
You didn't do fine. You need to do better.
No, I did fine.
You need to do better. That's just shoddy.
I really give a shit what you think of my parking job, okay, pal?
It's not an open field. This is not a farm, okay? Just park your car. Park your car between the lines. It's not that hard. Look, just pull in between the lines.
Why don't you stay between the lines of your own goddamn business, huh? Why don't you stay confined within the lines of not being an asshole? Because you're way over that line, all right?
The only person who's the asshole here is the Pig Parker.
A Pig Parker?
Yes.
So you're calling me a pig?
A Pig Parker.
Hey, you know what? Have a real nice day.
Okay, I will. I'm sure you will, too, at everyone else's expense.
Yeah, I will.
So I show up, and I didn't audition. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I got offered the
scene.
They
just said, come do this?
I mean, I know Jeff Garlin, and I... And I knew Jeff Schaefer of Berg Schaefer Mandel, the like, you know, best, you know, comedy trio writing team of all, you know, so many things.
Yeah,
Seinfeld, Curb, Borat. Incredible. So, like, I knew Jeff, And I showed up, and it's like a lot of waiting. And then they're like, okay, let's go. And so I get to set, and then Garland and Larry Charles and Larry David are sitting at a table. And I say hi to Garland, and Larry David's texting. He's like, Larry, I want you to meet one of the funniest guys coming up right now. This is Brett Gelman. And then Larry just like looked up at me and was like, hi, and then went back to texting, which I knew. I was like, of course.
Yeah.
Also, being a regular on a show, when you get, if you don't know, there's so many people that he has to deal with every mm-hmm. day. Like mm-hmm. a lot of people who come to guest on shows can be quite annoying, and they're not in the vibe, and you're in the flow of the people that you see all mm-hmm. the time, and yeah. so it's hard. It's hard to give your energy about, especially when you're somebody like him who's like manning the show and stuff like that. And so, and it was also like great because I want him, yeah. I don't want him to be yeah. like really nice and all
that's exactly what you want yeah. to expect. Yeah.
So we, you know, I had to park the car.
Mm-hmm.
That was the beginning of the scene.
Yeah.
So they gave me this huge truck and I couldn't see over the hood. I couldn't see the lines of the parking space. So it's rehearsal and I park, I get out of the car and he's walking to the car shaking his head. And I think we're about to start the scene. He's like, no. No, you see? You parked in the space perfectly.
Yeah, that's not what you were supposed
and
to
I
do.
And I looked out and I'm like, oh no, because I accidentally did that. And then he was like, you see, the whole concept of the bit is that you park outside of the lines. And that's why I get mad at you. And I'm like, no, I know, Larry, I'm not stupid. I'm sorry. I just couldn't see the lines. He's like, okay. So then I get in the car and I'm like, oh my God, I just ruined my dream. I yeah. can't believe it. I'm having a full-on panic attack. And I'm like, oh no, this is horrible. What am I going to do? Okay, you know, here's what I'll do. After I'm done with this, because I'm going to get cut. This scene's going to get cut. It's going to be a disaster. My agents are going to drop me, but I'll blame it on him. I'll call my agents and I'll say, Larry David was such an asshole
yeah.
that I couldn't do a good job. And then I'm like, whoa, no. Another voice kicked in that was like, no, you have to calm down and you have to do this or you will regret it the rest of your life. So we did the first take. And this the great thing about him is that, like, as awkward as he could seem socially, and I had very limited social interaction with him, so mm-hmm. I don't know how awkward he actually is, other than the few moments that we had, because it was pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
But he'll, like, break if yeah. you're being funny, and they're cross-covering it, you know, mm-hmm. meaning they have two cameras
yeah.
shooting to catch all the improv and the reactions. And so he will laugh. He'll break.
Yeah.
And that was more than any type of warm conversation than I could ever have. That mm-hmm. was way better.
Making
and so that
laugh.
Immediately yeah. injects you with a lot of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if maybe he's doing that on purpose. I don't know. But it, and then it just went off from there and it was really great. And so we did one take and we were like laughing together. I'm like, oh my God, I can't believe like I'm laughing at, with Larry David about mm-hmm. what we just did. And then we did a second take. And then at the end of that, we're laughing together. And I go, oh my God, man, it's just crazy, huh? It's just crazy. I mean, we're literally arguing about nothing. And then I was like, oh no, what the fuck did I just do? I just like said the most cliche thing from his last show.
Yeah.
And then he looks at me and he goes, yeah, well, you yeah. know, that's pretty much the basis of my whole career. and then it was great.
Yeah. yeah.
That's
great.
It was really amazing.
You also mentioned Eagle Heart.
Yeah.
Was Chris Elliott someone who you, you know, looked up to
oh, yeah.
coming up? And what was it like to work with him?
I mean, it was amazing. I mean, I learned a lot from him.
Mm-hmm.
He made me funnier. He taught me how to be funnier, and he taught me how to be tougher.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I worshipped him growing up, like him yeah. doing Late Night and then Get a Life, I think, is one of the best shows ever made. I think Cabin Boy is an incredible piece of work. Mm-hmm. And no, I mean, nobody has messed with me on the level that Chris Elliott has. I mean,
is there an example of that?
And
how would he mess
oh,
with
I
you?
Mean, just like, you're not good. You're terrible. Everybody thinks so. No, I mean, you would have to play his, it was like a bit. So mm-hmm. I would be his straight man. And I'd be like, no, people like me. You don't know what you're talking about. And he'd be like, no, they don't. They don't. But it's okay. And I'm like, no, they like me. They like me as an actor. They think I'm doing, or no, they like me as a person. They think I'm doing a good job. And he's like, no, they like you as a person, just not as an actor. You're terrible. But it's okay because we're all terrible. You know, I'm the best. Maria's in the middle. And you're the worst. And... No, you'd be doing like scenes and it'd be my coverage and he'd be off camera and like he'd be supposed to be reacting and like he would just be standing there with a dead face, just shaking his head, going like thumbs down. It was amazing. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe he meant it. I don't know.
Yeah, hard to know.
Yeah, it's hard. No, it is. I mean, I was caught in a table. Like there's this point where my character had his legs sawed off and I had to stay in this table, and it was really hot. We were shooting in this like warehouse in Santa Clarita that like had been had been like totally reworked into a set, a studio stage, but it had no air conditioning really. They were like doing it with these hoses, but you know it's August, it's not working.
Yeah.
So I'm sweating my ass off, and then he's like, "Oh, you know what, Brett? You smell like duty. You smell like duty. Hey, everyone, come and look. Come and smell Brett." And he had like a line, the crew like formed a line behind me and were smelling my butt. Yes. But that stuff, though, it was never demean. It always just felt like really fun and just like mean fun.
That's
and
his style.
And I love it.
Yeah.
I love mean comedy. Yeah. So, by the time I went back to my trailer that day, he had put a pair of tighty whities in there with brown marker rubbed in the butt of. And that stuff like made me. It taught me a lot about like being constantly funny.
Yeah,
and being just tough. Nobody can fuck with me now. I can take anything because of Chris, but I love him a lot. I love him a lot.
Yeah.
If something was actually wrong, he would be there for you.
Mm-hmm.
He had a big heart and he really took care of a lot. Cause you know, any show it's hard to do. And sometimes people are not being treated in the way they should. And he always would take care of people.
Yeah.
He was really a leader on the show.
You got to appear on the series finale of Mad Men,
yeah,
which must have been pretty surreal.
Yeah,
what was that experience like?
I felt like we were in this like beautiful setting, and there was a lot of waiting around, and I was like, "Am I dead?" I just felt like it felt like some version of heaven or purgatory, where you're in like, you know, very pleasant purgatory. And it was pretty wild, like being naked, but it was, I mean, that's one of my favorite shows of all time. And so even getting to be in it for a second was amazing. And, the weird thing was that like, I knew John Hamm before that.
Comedy super fan, John Hamm.
Yeah. John's always around and he's, you know, amazing, great guy. And I was like, this is so weird. I like looked at him once and he was like off on his own a lot, you know, dealing with the character and where the character was at. And I'm sure dealing with this massive thing that he was a part of coming to an end. And I was like, man, this is so tripped out, huh? He would check in with me, though. He'd be like, how are you doing? You know, and I'm like, this must be so tripped out for you that you're doing like the last moments of this show and then none of your regular cast is there.
Yeah.
But I'm here. He's like, yeah,
isn't that weird?
And I'm naked. And he's like, yeah, that is pretty weird. Okay, I got to go. Yeah, it was wild.
I also wanted to ask about Another Period, which is a fun one.
Yeah, very fun.
What's it like making that show?
It was Shonda Rhimes' favorite show.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she said it was her favorite show on TV.
It's unexpected.
Yeah, right? But kind of makes sense in a way. No, it doesn't. But, I mean, not that somebody wouldn't make that their favorite show, but that she, you know.
It just seems, yeah.
I mean, those are like, you know, so many of my old friends, you know, incredible cast. And I go way back with Natasha's, I think one of the best comedians of all time. And I love Ricky, you know, she's incredible. And so many of the people that I grew up with, looked up to, and then slightly younger than me, you know, cause there's like Michael Ian Black and then there's Armin Weitzman, you know, and it's like, and just, yeah, it was so fun. It was crazy. It was very much like, you know, felt like beautiful chaos. Mm-hmm. And I loved my character on that.
Yeah.
Speaking of a flawed male character.
Yeah. And then I wanted to just touch on Stranger Things because that's obviously probably a game changer for you in some ways, just in terms of the amount of people that see that show.
Big time.
Is that where, do you have a ton of people, new people recognizing you, do you think, from that?
Yeah.
And so,
people
so
are
what
like,
is...
where'd you come from? Like, well, I've had a bit of a career before. Yeah.
they think you came out of nowhere to be on Stranger Things.
Yeah. No, I mean, people, I'm like that guy in that show, and now I'm, you know, Murray and Stranger, Brett Gelman and Stranger Things.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I love it. I mean, it's one of the best things that I've ever worked on and seen. I think it's an incredible, incredible show. And I think the Duffers, you know, have a really real, very specific original vision.
Mm-hmm.
And, they wrote me an incredible character. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there, do you know about the future of that? Is your,
I don't. They keep it very secret, but
yeah,
I'm hoping that I'm a part of it. And yeah, I love the show. I love it as much as everybody else does.
Yeah.
And I really like wanted to, like when I first got, it's one of my dreams. You know, I grew up watching Spielberg movies and I wanted to be the like comedic character in the Spielberg movie. And this is the closest that, you know, I think you could get to it. Even I don't think you would get that even working with Spielberg now
he's doing such different kind of
stuff. His style changed. I mean, you know, and it's amazing. I mean,
You wouldn't turn down a Spielberg.
No, I'm not knocking Steven Spielberg. I think his new stuff is you know, completely special and genius too. But it's just different. It's not like it was in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So and the Duffers have their a completely original thing. I don't think they're ripping anybody off. And in the way that they borrow, it's like they borrow it in a way and then filter it through them and their take on it. And it's just such a blast. It was fun getting to work on that and Fleabag because I think there are a lot of similarities between the two shows and the making of the two shows.
Oh, really?
And the way that both creators are never satisfied and they're always, you know, they're never resting on their laurels. They're never, you know, they have such a distinct vision of what it is that you feel like almost like religious in serving. And then also both shows feel like this like tight knit family.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny when you're working on Stranger Things, it doesn't feel like this gigantic behemoth.
Yeah.
You know, even if you're on like a carnival set, it still feels like, okay, how do we get this? Like, you know, like you're working. It's great.
Yeah. So the final thing that we do on the show is I ask everyone what the last thing that made you laugh really hard is. If there's something you can think of, something you saw on TV or in the movies or on stage, just something that made you laugh that you could recommend to somebody else.
Oh, wow. Oh, you know what? I love that Tim Robinson show.
Yeah.
That is really...
I think that's been mentioned more on this show than anything else because it is so incredible.
Yeah, and I'm really... I think it's fantastic. I think he's really... Yeah, it's incredible. He's so funny. I love what... I think I heard him say that he like... He always loved the later sketches on SNL when he was there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that's so brilliant.
Yeah,
and
it's like a whole show of the later sketches.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it makes me laugh really hard.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I will see you at Friday Shabbat, I hope.
I hope so too. I know.
And, this was a lot of fun.
Now people can't steal the idea from me.
Nope.
Yeah.
You know, you'll know.
Yeah, totally.
Everyone will know.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you, buddy.
Thank you again to Brett Gelman. If you haven't already, you can watch Fleabag, which is nominated for 11 Emmys right now on Amazon Prime Video. And of course, Stranger Things Season 3 is streaming on Netflix as well. If you enjoy this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. The Last Laugh is distributed by Himalaya Media for The Daily Beast. It is produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch for Starburns Audio and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3.
You can find the show every week on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.